Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and I'm in Edinburgh for the 64th International Film Festival. Welcome to a special Film Weekly. This week we hear from the extraordinary French animator Sylvain Chaumet, whose film The Illusionist cast a spell over the city as the opening night gala. I talk to the Oscar-nominated Skandar Kopti about making his Israeli film Ajami on the mean streets of Jaffa. And I run through some of this week's cinema releases, including Nicole Holofcener's New York comedy Please Give and Ashton Kutcher in Killers. Will he be tweeting my review? It's kinder on the ears than the vuvuzelas and, dare I say, the bagpipes. It's Film Weekly. So we're here again, back in the beautiful city of Edinburgh, for a festival rapidly making its mark as the place to discover and nurture new talent from around the world. The festival, which runs until June the 27th, has the usual showcase of British talent too, but it kicked off on Wednesday night with The Illusionist, an animated film by Francis Sylvain Chaumet, he of the superbly distinctive cycling cartoon Belleville Rendezvous. Festivities began by turning the handsome old festival theatre here first into a cinema, then into a vaudevillian treat, complete with feathered dancing girls, a brass band, and miming mustachioed magicians. Then came The Illusionist, a beautiful, melancholic animation about a magician from Paris trying to find an audience and a family in Edinburgh. After the screening, I met up with its creator, Sylvain Chaumet, to find out why Edinburgh became his spectacular backdrop. I'm with Sylvain Chaumet, whose film The Illusionist opened the 64th Edinburgh International Film Festival. And it's hard to imagine another film that could possibly have done it with such an élan, with such kind of magic, with such a flourish as your film. It's almost seemed to be made to open the Edinburgh Film Festival. What's your relationship with the Edinburgh Film Festival, Sylvain?
Well, my relationship is very simple. I was invited in 2004 to present the Triplets of Belleville in Edinburgh.
Belleville Rendezvous, we call it here.
Oh, yes, yes. Actually, it's the only place in the world where it's called Belleville Rendezvous. But I was invited, and then I discovered the city and you know, people and Scotland, and I came back. I was just on my own with my daughter, and she was 10 years old at that time. And I came back to see my wife and say, you know, I found this amazing place. And we were living in Normandy at that time. Yeah. And it was a bit grey and cold and a bit remote. Mm-hmm. So I said, let's go to an even more remote place. But I mean,
what was it about Edinburgh that so attracted you? Because I mean, obviously, Triplet de Belleville, you have Paris, which is a beautiful city and great for an animator like yourself. And you obviously love the characters and the buildings. But obviously, from looking at your cartoon vision of Edinburgh, that seems to have attracted you as well, the actual geography of the place.
Yes, yes. But it comes in two times. So we moved to Edinburgh, we opened our studio, and then we managed to start our film, The Illusionist. And I was working at the adaptation, and I said to myself, there's no other place I can actually set this film apart from Scotland, because I'm living in it, and you know, I can breathe the air, I can see the lights changing and all these things, and I know that, you know, I'm experimenting it, so I need to be. You know, I have to change the whole location of the film. And it worked actually even better than in the original script. It was supposed to be in Prague.
Uh-huh. Because it's about an illusionist who travels around, yeah. Traveling with his show after it fails in Paris and London. He comes to Scotland in your film. So in the original Tati script, he goes to Czechoslovakia.
He was going to Prague, yes, at the end. But it wasn't working really well because it's in a very bizarre way. It was the first sequence we were starting in London, where there was a realistic singer, which is much more French. And then they were going to Paris, where there were a rock band, which is much more London. Then he goes to to Czechoslovakia. And outside Czechoslovakia, they wouldn't have electricity. It was a bit weird. And then going in Prague, they would have these amazing shops and things like that. But that was at a period, you know, where it was, you know, behind the Iron Curtain. Mm. So by having Tati starting his trip from Paris and arriving to Iona and then going to Edinburgh, it really makes sense to a point which was a bit spooky. That's actually when I went on Merle and to try to see Iona, to go on Iona. Mm-hmm. I couldn't go because of the weather and the ferry wouldn't go to Iona. so I could see Iona from a distance. So I bought a book about the story of Iona, and the film is supposed to be set in 1959, and I've read 1959, the, all the dates of the 1959 arrival of the electricity on Iona. They had a party. That was just amazing. It was historically working as well.
Right, because one of the things about your film, which is very interesting, at the start it says Paris 1959. But then there are certain times in the film where I wasn't sure what period it was. And I assume, I hope this is a compliment, that it was a sort of timeless kind of piece.
Well, yes, it is timeless, but because as well it takes place... It's timeless because you know you know that what's happening you know in the world, you know that it's the beginning of the use of television, rock and roll, and the invention of teenagers. So you know it's at the end of the 50s, but as well when he moves to Scotland, this is where you know it's a bit timeless because even now you know if you go to the West Islands in Scotland, it's timeless. You can't really say you know what time it is. It's still very much. Out of the world, yeah. In a nice way.
Because there's a mix that with the cars as well, even with the black cabs. I was thinking, well, they look kind of like they look now. And Edinburgh, looking at it, you know, in your film last night, looks not much changed. I've been coming here for 20 years, and I always kind of wonder, the interiors have changed, and some of the bars have got smarter, if you like. But really, it looks like it has always looked.
Yes, it didn't change Edinburgh, but we had a lot of research about you know what buildings were still there because there have been some shopping center you know.
Yeah.
So they have to destroy some parts of the city, but mostly it didn't change much. I think it was a bit more dark because of the smoke at that time.
Yeah.
But for the cabs, you know, we really actually used models. Which were the cabs from that period.
Oh, okay.
And the buses as well, they were buses from that period, which for us was good that Princess Street, for example, were just with cars and buses. But if it was 10 years before, there would have been trams.
Yes.
And they're going to put the trams again.
Yeah.
So there was a period without the trams.
Yeah, I think the town has undergone quite a transformation in the last 10 years. But when I first came, it looked pretty much like it does in your film, which is always one of the great charms of it. You know, you could get frothy white coffees as well in Edinburgh. And there was a mix of the Italians, which you have in your Garagiste, is an Italian mix. And that's a kind of great heritage of Edinburgh. I wonder if also if this... this sticking to, I suppose, an old-fashioned illusionist, a magician, if you like. There's something about you, because it was very refreshing to watch a film that wasn't in 3D, that didn't have, you know, squirrels from Brooklyn making jokes, and animals kind of pretending that they were kind of, you know, old Hollywood stars.
No, we have a rabbit from France, and he's not making jokes. He's a disaster. Yeah, but I mean, it wouldn't have been appropriate to do it in 3D. This film is. I wanted to prove something with this film. I wanted really to prove that you can do animated films which are on a slower pace, you know, and that you can, which needs reflection, which we need the audience to participate into it, and just to get that emotion growing at the end, you know, you can't have a. Anybody from Brooklyn making jokes, you wouldn't have any emotion.
No. I mean, do you feel that this is, you know, a very difficult thing to do these days because the success of films from Pixar, which I'm sure you admire in their certain way?
Yes, of course, yeah. Yeah, yes. I really think that Pixar have really made some really awful films. The last two films, which are Wall-E and... And Up are really, really excellent films. But I don't see the relation with what I'm doing because when you do 3D animation, you don't need to know how to draw.
Mm.
You know, it's virtual puppeting. It's because of this story after Toy Story, you know, the Disney studio decided that 2D was dead and everybody should do 3D. But it's a very bizarre thing to say because it's absolutely not the same way to animate or it doesn't work with the same tools. Why would you know? It's like saying that television would have killed the radio.
Mm-hmm.
I've got nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Just finally, before I go, I'm looking at the newspapers this morning, and there's a story from Paris about Jacques Tati, on whom your film to whom your film owes so much, and about his lost daughter, and the daughter he abandoned, if you like. Was this a story you knew, or is this something that the film was destined to kind of reveal? Because that's what at the heart of this story is. If there is something going on, it's a little vague in your film. But you know, what is the reality and and how did it come into the fiction?
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with me because I'm just making films, and I adapted the script, and I've put a lot of my own experience as well, and I've transformed the script to have it personal, and it's got nothing to do with this story. But I think that person is trying, I mean, the person who's claiming this kind of thing is trying to claim something with the estate in France. But it's got nothing to do with me. I'm not an estate from Tati, and I'm not Jacques Tati either. And I'm convinced that this film was made for his daughter, the daughter he actually lived with. So he knew what
Sophie,
and he knew what a little girl was, and how she was going to change into a woman, and all this kind of mystery about it. How do a little girl change into a woman? And also because he was feeling that he wasn't spending enough time with Sophie and his family, because he was so much into his film, the making of his film. And it was definitely a love letter for a daughter which he loved and actually lived with.
Stéphane Chaumet, félicitations.
Merci.
Thank you very much. Very nice to meet you. And congratulations on The Illusionist, which cast a magic spell on Edinburgh last night at the opening.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, despite the World Cup, or maybe to spite the World Cup, it's a busy week at the cinemas across the UK. Here are my reviews of a few you might want to see. Please Give is the latest film from Nicole Holofcener, a director who's earned herself the reputation of being the female Woody Allen through recent angsty funny films such as Walking and Talking and Lovely and Amazing. In Please Give, Holofcener's frequent muse and mouthpiece, indie goddess Catherine Keener, plays a Manhattan woman who buys up collectible mid-20th century furniture from the grieving relatives of the recently deceased, then flogs them in a smart Lower East Side store she runs with her smug husband, played by Oliver Platt. Their comfy lives cross those of a pair of bickering sisters, Rebecca Hall and Amanda Peet, whose 91-year-old grandma lives in the apartment next door, Keener and Platt, a prime piece of New York real estate just waiting to be annexed.
You got a handsome boy there.
Thank you, Andra.
It's the truth. But he's very short.
Grandma.
That's good. Otherwise, he would never go for you if he was tall.
Becca is a lovely girl, and I'm sure a lot of boys notice her.
What did I say? I didn't say anything.
Holofcener has a breezy charm with her camera, nailing the wants and worries of the city in the way that Woody used to. The film's very specificity gives it likability and exoticism. We don't love the characters exactly, but we want their lives, their neuroses, their milieu. This is a caustically funny, elegantly fashioned movie, wise, witty and moving, and chock full of themes and patterns without ever seeming schematic or symbolic. The rude grandma is terrific, Rebecca Hall superb, and the overall effect quietly winning.
You point your gun at him. It's shooting.
What? Don't do it! You're crazy! It's a psychotic break! Don't do it!
Just shoot him, please!
Killers is a mishmash of rom-com, spy spoof, consumer satire, and Ashton Kutcher's abs. In it, the actor plays a CIA agent vowing to go straight after falling in love with Katherine Heigl, having bumped into her in Antibes, France. After a mildly diverting opening set in the Hotel du Cap on the Côte d'Azur, we cut to the settled life of American suburban bliss the couple now have, if somewhat overprotected by Heigl's parents, played by Tom Selleck, yes, still with a moustache, and Catherine O'Hara, who plays a hopeless lush. At least, I think she was acting drunk. It might have been the only way a decent actress could get through this. Directed by Robert Legally Blonde Luketic, the comic action, in truth it's neither funny nor exciting, mounts as it turns out half the suburban enclave wants to kill Ashton Kutcher too. As entertainment goes, this flat-footed farce is slightly better than a 0-0 opening round World Cup match. But not much. Really, not much. Hardly a week goes by these days without some veteran French director making a return to the big screen. After André Téchiné recently, now comes Alain René, the former avant-garde master of Last Year in Marienbad and the vital Night and Fog, aged 87 now and, I'm afraid, showing it with Wild Grass. It's what Tarantino calls an old man movie, a whimsical mystery about André Dussolier, who discovers a wallet in a car park and, after tracing her, begins a flirtatious affair with its owner, a batty aviatrix played by flame-haired actress Sabine Azima.
Et bien voilà, je voulais vous remercier.
C'est tout?
Quoi d'autre?
Vous me décevez beaucoup.
René uses ace young cinematographer Eric Gauthier to create a twinkling palette of neons and soft focus interiors, but the accumulation of voiceover and monologue, odd wipes, fades and dissolves diminish any narrative momentum, and despite cameos by actors of the calibre of Mathieu Amalric, Emmanuel DeVos and Sarah Forestier, the prissy bourgeois characters soon exhaust any audience goodwill. In a way, I hope this is not the director's swan song, but then again... Another must-see film out this week is Ajami, by the unlikely directing duo of Skander Kopti and Yaron Shani. The first, a Palestinian citizen of the Israeli state, the second, an Israeli Jew. Oscar-nominated earlier this year, the film is the latest example of flourishing Israeli cinema. Ajami, named after the multicultural neighbourhood of coastal Jaffa where it's set, tells a complex interwoven story of gang violence and its impact on everyday life. I spoke to one half of the directing team, Skander Kopti, from Tel Aviv, to find out more about how they made the film. But first, let's hear a clip from that troubled neighbourhood of Ajami. Skander, congratulations on Ajami. It's a very powerful piece of work, but also very something very different from Israel. We know Israel is making many interesting films at the moment, but nothing quite like Ajami. Was the idea to do something different that had never been done before in Israeli Arab cinema?
Yeah, well, actually, the intention wasn't to make something that was never done before. The intention was simply telling the story, our story, which has never been told before. Because usually when you speak about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you will probably see stories or films about the West Bank and Israel and the occupation, when in general people tend to forget that there's 1.5 million Palestinians living as second-class citizens inside the Green Line. And because we come, both of us, Yaron and I, we come from an artistical approach that believes that reality is much more interesting than our very narrow imagination. So we based everything on reality, and especially on the reality that we know.
Do you live in Ajami yourself?
Yes, I was born and raised in Ajami, and I lived all my most of my life in Ajami, except for a couple of years when I went to university in Haifa.
Right, so I mean, so just describe for people back here, because it's the sort of place that people, I think, who look at the news, who look at you know, the current affairs of the Middle East, they have no idea that somewhere like Ajami exists. It's quite an urban place. It sort of, the way you paint it, it looks more like, I don't know, something like South Central LA or Brooklyn, yeah, or something.
Well, Ajami is basically is in the city of Jaffa, which is now with a Jewish majority and a Palestinian minority. When Jaffa, well, everybody know it from the brand of the oranges. Jaffa was a huge cultural, I mean, it was the cultural capital of Palestine before 48. And day after the 15th of May 1948, the population went from 120,000 to become only a few thousands, and most of them not from Jaffa, because a lot of refugees came to live in Jaffa, and they were fenced and put in this big neighborhood beside the beach, which was called Ajami.
Right.
And actually, this is how it all started. It's a very small population of different coming from different places with different religions and different social classes, all put in this melting pot under this oppression for such a long time.
It's fascinating because I've been to Jaffa and I've been to the old town, you know, which is a rather beautiful place now, kind of populated
touristic.
By artists for tourists as well. It's kind of very pretty, and you can walk there from Tel Aviv. It's like, you know, 10 minutes walk down the beach, really.
Yeah, actually, Jaffa, the old Jaffa, is like 10 minutes away from Tel Aviv, but a million light years away in terms of how life is. And well, Ajami the movie is not Ajami, the real Ajami the neighborhood is not only what is shown in the movie. In the movie, we did a zoom in into this very specific dark corner of the neighborhood, when in fact in the neighborhood you have all sorts of people, and not only crime or people living in the shadows of crime. Dramatically, those stories were better for us. And I can tell you that all the events of this film were, all the stories in this film were based on true events.
Right, because I think people, when they hear a story that, you know, directed by an Israeli and an Arab Israeli, a Palestinian like yourself, they think it's going to be about the tension. Obviously, the face of it's going to be, as you say, a military tale in a way. But yours is about everyday tales of, you know, of crime, of warring clans. That's a Bedouin clan and an Arab clan, then a Christian and a Muslim romance. And you've got all of these things going on in there. It's about humans trying to live their lives against the backdrop of all these tensions, isn't it?
Exactly. These are simple stories of everyday life, very, very human stories, and which basically come to show that different people have different approaches or different point of views, as the film suggests, to the same reality. And this is actually what is what you can see in Ajami. And those different point of views, they clash together, you know, and they create this mess, and people do horrible things one to another just because their point of views are different.
Do you think that most people, if they saw Ajami, they would get a new look at Israel and the sort of the way that society is structured and the way that people are trying to live their lives? And I think people think that everyone there is either throwing rocks or is a member of the army. You know, it's one of they forget that there are actual people trying to live normal lives. There are chefs. There are people who are having love affairs. There are people who run restaurants. There are people who have got big houses. There are people who have got poor houses. There are people who there are mothers who love their children. There are children who are devoted to their fathers. There are people who want to get out. There are people who want to stay in.
Well, exactly, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Skanda, you yourself play in the film as well. You play a chef, sort of, who has a bit of fun, has a Jewish girlfriend, is quite a kind of controversial figure. In a way, I thought that was interesting that you were playing it because you were also, working with Yaron here. You were kind of, you know, being an Arab filmmaker, but you were working with a Jewish filmmaker as well.
The story of Binge is nothing far from reality. Those things happen, as you mentioned. People are people, they're human, and they love and they hate and they have girlfriends. And a lot of time it happens that a Palestinian has a Jewish girlfriend and vice versa. Actually, we decided at the end that I will portray the character of Binge, because a lot of the characteristics of Binge, not in terms of story, because I never had a Jewish girlfriend, but in terms of how he deals with life, is a lot similar to my personal life. And because I am a kind of an actor, I was acting since the age of 10 in different things that I wrote, and I love it.
And is that your own beard? Do you still have that beard? It's a very special kind of, that's a good bit of work.
If I take it off, nobody will recognize me. I have it now for at least 12.
You got to keep
years.
That, otherwise no one's going to believe it's kind of like Cockney. You know?
Yeah. I've got to keep it.
Yeah, but be careful, because if you're a chef, I think it could get in some of the sauces, because it's quite a long,
Well,
beard.
Actually, I was at the restaurant that we shot the film in, and I used to work there for 3 years. And a lot of the stories came from this restaurant, so for me it wasn't far away from my everyday life, you know, cooking in this restaurant. And also the other parts that you will see in the film, a cop in the film, a policeman in the film, is a real policeman.
Right.
And a 13-year-old kid from Ajami is a real 13-year-old kid from Ajami. So everybody was chosen in similarity to the character he's going to portray.
Because, I mean, is this right? You shot hours and hours of footage with these people, these non-professional actors. You workshop them and you had so much footage that you almost had a doc. That's how you make documentaries, really. And then you kind of, you know, you sculpted away to get the narrative drive of your film. Or did you know exactly sort of all the different levels and different kind of strands of story that you would have?
Well, we spent 3.5 years writing the screenplay to the last detail of it with dialogues and everything. But then we decided, in order to keep the authenticity of the film, we decided to work with non-professionals and to workshop them, where we trained them to do improvisations on fictional situations, but on situations that are very close to their everyday life. So eventually we shot the film with two cameras chronologically, you know, because we didn't give anybody a screenplay. Nobody knew what's going to happen, so we had to shoot the film chronologically. And then we ended up with something like 80 hours of footage with two cameras, and we spent 14 months editing them. Wow. Yaron and myself. We didn't have an editor. We edited the film
together. You sat together, the Palestinian and the Jew, or you did it like on the other side of a?
No. We're good friends. We live not far away. Actually, now you caught me in the car, and I'm going. We're going out with Yaron and his wife.
Yeah, really?
Wife,
this is a love. This is a bit. I can feel some love. It sounds like a Kiara Starmi movie. Actually, just because you've got like sounds like the little cut. It's really nice. Actually, it's giving me a real feel for the streets of Ajami. So you are, yeah, as we're speaking, you're going to go out with your partner in the film, Yaron Shani, for dinner with your partner and his wife.
Yes,
that's lovely.
With my partner, my wife, and I, and his my partner and his wife to have sushi.
To have sushi.
You're more than welcome.
Oh, yeah. I would love some sushi. It's nice to see. It's all kosher, I hope. But are you celebrating? Because, you know, the film has done so well. It did. You got an Oscar nomination, which is extraordinary. And I always think with Israeli films, Arab films, I don't know if you make it for an audience in Israel or you make it for an audience on a wider scale. Because also you have the other problem that as an Arab filmmaker, probably your film won't be able to be seen in many of the Arab countries where it might actually be very useful for it to be seen.
Yeah, well, we reached the Oscars, and we never thought about it. We never thought the film is going to be a hit in Israel, both on the Palestinian and Israeli side. And it's going to be, although it cannot, it will not be shown in cinemas in Arab countries. But the film is already showing in Arab countries. It was pirated. I mean,
yeah.
So people from Lebanon. People from Lebanon send me emails. They say, I regret it so much that I bought it from the market, but, you know, on Facebook, but I love the film and this and that. So people watch it, and a lot of the Arab world watched it in Europe, in Paris.
Yeah, I bet they don't send you any money. They don't send you a couple of shekels and say thanks for that anyway.
One of them, actually, it was funny. One girl, she contacted me and she said that she went to her friend's house in Beirut and there was Ajami. And she said, this is not right, guys. And she asked me how much 5 tickets will cost, and she wanted to send me the money. But I said, come on, I'm inviting you to the film.
Well, I think it's great. I mean, it's out in the UK now, and I think people will be very intrigued to see it. It's a very new kind of look at Israeli mm-hmm. cinema. Where do you think it stands? Because I'm just before we finish, I want to talk about the explosion of Israeli cinema that's been reaching our shores here. I mean, in the last few weeks, we've had Lebanon, we've had Eyes Wide Open, we've had, you know, in the past, Waltz with Bashir, we've had the Lemon Tree. Such an explosion of Israeli cinema. And I think your cinematographer, actually, Boaz, he shot also My Father, My Lord. There's a lot going on in Israeli cinema for a country that, you know, has a lot on its mind, let's face it, politically and economically. Yeah. There's a flourishing of cinema. Is there a reason for that? Can you see why? And is that wave going to continue?
I think there was always good cinema here because, as I told you, it's a place full of conflicts. And conflicts, they create good drama, and then you have beautiful stories that interest everybody, because, you know, this is the heart of the world here, the Holy Land, and everybody is interested in it. But I think that now, because of the co-productions we have with Europe, and especially with Germany, France, and the UK, and also some co-productions with Canada and other places, I think the world is more open to receive films from abroad, and people in Europe, they watch international films.
Yes, there's someone in the Israeli Film Fund, isn't there? There's a head of the Israeli Film Fund who's also kind of been very kind of important in the flourishing of this as well. Yes. I don't know his name. Gabriel Shoria.
He's a great man. He's done a lot for the local cinema here, and he's pushing a lot the things of co-productions with Germany. And he's helping it, and he's promoting the cinema here.
Yes, that's what I feel. Like, that's very. It's become one of the you know the places in world cinema at the moment where things yes. are happening. So I hope things are going to happen for you, Skander Kopti and Yaron Shani. You can discuss a future project over some sushi. Wouldn't it be lovely if the Middle East peace process could be solved by people sharing a sushi of peace, Skander?
It would be lovely, but we have to keep on dreaming.
Absolutely.
It will take more time than dipping a sushi in a soya sauce.
Do you think? Well, anyway, but good luck. Don't overdo it on the wasabi. And good luck with that, Ajami, as it's released in the UK. Thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you very much. Have a nice meal. Bye-bye.
Bye. Many thanks to Skander Kopti from Tel Aviv there. And for more information on Ajami, check out their website, kino.com/Ajami. That is all for this week. I'll be back next week with more from my adventures at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. But if you can't wait, do pick up this Sunday's Observer. I'm filling in for Philip French this week and reporting from Edinburgh. Oi, am I busy? Till then, from me, an exhausted Jason Solomons, and Phil Weekly's equally exhausted producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.